All right, we are live with Alexander Mekuris in London. And today we are joined once again on the Duran with the fantastic Mel Kay from the Mel Kay Show. How are you doing today? And where can people find you?
Oh, I am doing great. People can find me. I have a daily show at noon Eastern time every day on Rumble. I have great interviews over the weekend, and I am everywhere except for still battling YouTube, but you can find me on X and most platforms. Rumble is my home, though.
All right. Definitely, definitely look for Mel Kay's show on Rumble, and I follow Mel Kay on Twitter. Or X, as the cool kids call it nowadays. and let's say a quick hello to everyone that is watching us on Rockfin, on Odyssey, on Rumble, and YouTube, and our locals community, theduran.locals.com. A big shout out to our moderators as well.
Oh, cool.
Alexander, Mel Kay, let's talk about the deep state. We got a lot of ground to cover, so let's just jump right into it.
Indeed, let's indeed talk about the deep state. It's a topic that we hear a great deal about today. It's this expression that people only started to use, I think, relatively recently during Trump's first term. But of course, I, who was born in the 1960s, just before the assassination of President Kennedy, even in the 1960s as a child, I can remember people talking about a kind of permanent government that existed mostly in the United States, but which has its, if you like, its subsidiaries in overseas subsidiaries in other places, or maybe that's where their headquarters are, maybe somewhere in Europe and the subsidiaries are in the US. I sometimes wonder, living in London, whether it might be here, because we also probably have a deep state too, and perhaps an even older one than you do in the United States. But anyway, it is something which is very contrary, and this is a thing to say, very contrary and very strongly warned against by the founders of the American Republic. I mean, they would have regarded the existence of such a thing as absolutely horrifying and completely contrary to the Republican concept that they were trying to create in the United States. There is no doubt at all that it exists. Anybody who thinks it doesn't is deluding themselves. If somebody tells you that it doesn't exist, well, be very careful about who they are. That's the first thing to say. Now, nobody better, I think, to talk about this enormous but very important subject than Mel Kay. It is the second time we have her. We should have had her on our programs long ago. I massively enjoyed the previous program that we did, and I'm very much looking forward to this one, even though this is a rather dark subject in some ways. But nobody else can cast light on it, I think, and talk about it as well and as interestingly as Mel Kay. And of course, as I understand it, you are in the throes of a great deal of research and about this, and you're going to be writing about this fairly soon, or maybe you already are.
Yeah.
So, Mel, with that, let's go straight in. What is the deep state? Does it exist? I'm sure it does. I'm sure we'll agree that it does. But what is it exactly? It's a word people use an awful lot, expression people use an awful lot. But what is it, in fact?
Well, in my opinion, it's evolved quite a bit. I believe the deep state was already in play before World War II, certainly when the Federal Reserve started in America. In my opinion, I don't think that the Crown really accepted the idea that there was a American Revolution and instead redoubled their efforts to come through and infiltrate America, as JFK called infiltration instead of invasion, through the banking industry. And of course, that's global. And from what I can see, that was the beginning. But the real damage was done. I believe the betrayal of nation states, particularly ours, both of ours, was in the period after World War II, between 1944 and 1954. It seems to me that a bunch of people, while our families and friends and relatives were dying on the battlefields of Europe, there were a whole bunch of bankers and lawyers and international moguls of industry meeting regularly in Switzerland where Alan Dulles happened to be based during World War II. And he was working quite a bit with something I believe that everyone in America should be asking about, which is the Bank of International Settlements. And when I look at what's going on and how this really evolved in my work now, what it seems is that during World War II, now most people know at this point, if you haven't read Anthony Sutton's books or any of the books about the financial system prior to World War II, a lot of it was one foot in Wall Street and one foot in the city of London and another, maybe a hand over there in Germany. So a lot that was happening to rearm, remember, you know, Germany wasn't supposed to rearm and rebuild their military and everything else after World War One. And the first fraud was that the Bank of International Settlements would be the bank for reparations for Germany to pay. They had this Young's plan and the Dawes plan and all this stuff. So they established the Bank of International Settlements under that idea of paying reparations. But what happened instead, from what I can see, is that particularly industries like the Rockefeller Standard Oil, Ford, IBM, a lot of different companies in that same realm, Wall Street firms, were opening subsidiaries in Germany during the time between World War One and World War Two, or at least refueling them. JP Morgan sent money there. I believe many people, particularly lawyers from Wall Street, because both Dulles brothers were Wall Street lawyers at Sullivan and Cromwell, were involved in helping to build the Hitler's machine straight out of the financial system. And what I see has happened is that what we have now, say, the global public-private partnership that stands above us as a kind of parent company front group for the international banking cartel is still carrying on the same way, where they do not look at nation states as relevant. They don't look at boundaries or borders as relevant. National sovereignty to this group of people is a myth. It is something that they let the people believe. And this was all basically set up. Now, a lot of people that were in Wall Street seem to have backed Hitler in terms of even siding with them. We all know that the Nazis had a big parade in at Madison Square Garden, you know, when they were coming up and everything. And I do believe that by 1944, there was already a plan to get all the billions and billions and billions of dollars from the 60 million people that were affected by World War II out of Germany through rat lines, be it Italy, Argentina, elsewhere. And I think a lot of that money came into America under the guise of shell companies or front companies. We know that obviously Standard Oil was very involved with IG Farben during the war. We know that President Bush, his father, Preston Bush, was called out for doing banking with Nazis. We know that Alan Dulles was in Bern, Switzerland at the same time. The guy that was running the Bank of International Settlements, his name is McKittrick, also an American. I believe that they were setting up this framework that is still protected by something called the International Organization Immunity Act of 1945. To create a global infrastructure. They wanted that after World War I. And I believe that a lot of the reasoning for going into World War II was more about consolidating power and the world order that George H.W. Bush announced to the world when he became president. He left out financial. So what I believe is that that Bank of International Settlements, now the two players with Dulles and the Dulles brothers and McKittrick were Scharf, who was the head of the Nazi bank, the Reich Bank, and a guy named Norman, who was the head of the city of the Bank of England. And what they were doing at this time was encourage everyone in the ally countries to put their gold in the Bank of International Settlements. And then they would trade back and forth having to do with reparations and this and that. But as the Nazis gained power, Scharf, who was the, you know, he's on the, also on the board of Bank of International Settlements. So the Bank of International Settlements, we have to understand, had people from every country basically in Europe, but also the U.S. did not join it at first. It was instead the private banks of Morgan and the Bank of New York and the Bank of Chicago joined as kind of the American wing there. And what it appears happened is that they set up an international framework to basically have a financial world system that would have its tentacles in every country, controlling them from above through the financial systems. And of course, after that, you know, they came with the IMF and the World Bank and all of this stuff. At the same time, in tandem, they're coming in with their second iteration of the League of Nations, the United Nations, which also has this immunity that they've all decided upon in 1945 that 63 banks underneath the Bank of International Settlements and 76 organizations under the United Nations all got this kind of immunity on the world stage, no matter where they were, that they still have. And you can look up, it's still in effect, meaning that they could not be audited. They could not be investigated. The people that are in there could not be stopped at customs. They basically were opaque to anyone outside. And again, that the Bank of International Settlements would call themselves non-political, but everything they were doing was affecting everyone else, every country's politics, because they were manipulating from the top. And if you start there, then you start to see out of that came what I believe is really the worst thing that happened to the United States was, now remember, both Dulles brothers are lawyers. McKittrick was a lawyer. So these guys are all in Switzerland. And to me, what it looks like is not only were they funneling money out of Germany after Hitler surrendered, so to speak, but that they planned to keep it going, this war for profit machine that they created, particularly during World War II with the industries. And from that point on, the birth of the CIA is in question, because my question at this point during my research is, does the CIA actually work for the international banking cartel rather than for our country or any country? And is MI6, the CIA, and possibly maybe the Mossad, are they all one? Because what I see now is the characters that were in Switzerland, that were around the Bank of International Settlements, they all were talking about kind of what is in Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, which is basically these dumb, you know, peasants, humans, because we know later Rockefeller and them came up with the Club of Rome and limits of growth and everything is the human's fault. And of course, these greater beings that are part of the superclass, as they call themselves, had to organize on a global stage to basically, I think, push the world into some kind of global socialism to some extent that had a technocratic edge by saying this is all about fair international trade, fair international finance, when it really looks like, no, it's really about deceiving nation states into believing that they are sovereign when really they can't do anything without the international banks being involved. So, I mean, where I see it now is I think that the CIA, from its inception, was never a intelligence agency to protect the United States of America. And rather, when the Dulles brothers came back, John Foster Dulles, State Department, and his brother, CIA, that from that point on, I think the State Department of the United States and the CIA, and then you can add, of course, their money bags over at USAID, became partners of this charade of sovereign nation states. While they kind of decided, kind of like a parent company for the last, you know, since they've gotten away with it, that they will leave the illusion while they instead meet at conferences. And, you know, Bilderberg was probably the first one, you know, and then you look at the birth of NATO and all of that. And then a very ugly picture for the United States is what McCloy and Dulles did during Nuremberg, which was go in and pull a lot of scientists, a lot of bankers, a lot of economists, a lot of people out of Nuremberg, some that were sentenced to death, because a lot of people were aware that IG Farben and Standard Oil, which is the Rockefellers, were doing all kinds of business during World War II. They were, you know, the whole thing. And And really what it appears is that from that point on, the Bilderberg meeting, Davos, the COP conferences, you know, any number of the world government meetings, all this stuff is really what they consider the world government that is truly running the financial system, the endless wars for profit. I believe these people planned World War III before World War II was over. And then a lot of people don't realize, you know, we were all told that this Marshall Plan was going to refund, you know, and rebuild Europe. Instead, it built the EU and the European Euro and also helped fund with the help of Kissinger and Brzezinski and the whole Rockefeller crew helped build the World Economic Forum. So when you look at it and you take a step back, you say, oh, so they were putting together a global structure of control based on paying for both sides of war, a ground game for color, for basically regime change for anyone that questioned their control. And I believe that we've been in this cycle ever since. And like you said, if you look at George Washington's farewell address, that was what was meant to be America, a neutral nation. We were neutral. And frankly, I think Wilson probably worked for the crown rather than the United States of America. But from that point on of the Federal Reserve, and then I think that the whole plan and the game and the deep state was all about protecting the City of London, Wall Street, and frankly, the military-industrial complex, which they realized was the biggest profit-making machine on the planet. And so, like I say, I don't think the deep state is American. Frankly, I don't think it's anything. I think it's more like how Orwell described the state in 1984. In 1984, Orwell kind of made fun of the Nazis and the Chinese and their way of doing it, and said that the state in that book had no allegiance or alliance to any flag, any nation, any people, any country, any culture, anything. It was power for power's sake. And basically, if you were in that club, then you would be rewarded. And then, of course, we know that the universities, particularly I believe the London School of Economics, Oxford and Cambridge as well, but then all the Ivy League schools, and then University of Chicago and some of these other places, also, I believe, started down the path of, you know, getting the children, our youth over years, indoctrinated into a kind of accepting a global Marxist, totalitarian, technocratic system that nothing we could do nothing about. And so we've continued down this path where, you know, lobbying is somehow legal, which is just legalized bribery. Everyone's getting the Project for a New American Century then decided that they were going to militarize the world. You know, Russia fought with us in World War II, as did China. But Dulles and Churchill and a bunch of people were like, wait a minute, now we have to fight the Cold War against communism. And what I believe at this point, particularly for the people of the United States of America, when you look at our debt, I am pretty convinced that this international banking cartel and their global public-private partnership, which started before World War II, this conglomerate of multinational corporations that then have different names in different countries, but at the board level, they're all the same people. What I believe is that they've gotten to a place where that is what they're trying to protect. And by any means necessary, be it by pulling a coup in the United States of America in 2016, overthrowing a duly elected president, because we have to remember that was not a U.S. operation. That happened to be a Five Eyes operation. And you always have to ask yourself, what is that about? And even the expansion of NATO. Again, Gorbachev was promised by James Baker, we're not going to expand NATO after the end of the war. George Soros comes out in 93 with the Open Society Declaration of a NATO World Order. 2 years later, Bill Clinton's expanding NATO for no reason. So to me, what I'm seeing is also an endless desire to use Bernays and propaganda and public opinion to get the people of our countries to support endless war, which at the end of the day is about profit in reconstruction after the destruction. And that's where I feel in my own book, Americans Anonymous, which is a 12-step program based on AA. I basically say America, but frankly, also the UK. And I think most of Europe are as sick as our secrets, because our true history has been lied to. We've been lied to about it and taught for decades, I believe, not to look above, we're all fighting each other on the streets. We're all doing this where they open our borders. They're not opening the border of China. They're not opening the border of India. They're not only of the Western Atlantic nations. So, you know, to me at this point, the deep state defined, I believe, is a, like I said, it is a global public-private partnership in cahoots with an international banking system that bases everything on swaying public opinion to benefit them to continue down the road of basically not just war for profit, but also everything that they've done, the global warming, the global pandemic, the global everything. It all comes back to this 1944-1945 International Immunities Act for these organizations and banks that is still in place and I believe still functions above all of our governments.
Well, first of all, thank you. That's a huge amount to go through there. But let me just make a few quick observations and we can take them first. Further. First of all, either you're absolutely right to look at finance. I think finance is where it begins. And I'm going to say this, I think it begins here in London. American capital and British capital tended to meet in London. But right. 20 minutes from where I live, JP Morgan's house in London was. He spent half his time in London. He spent about 6 months of the year in London. In New York, if you go to his house in New York, which is still there, it's relatively small. His house in London is enormous. It is huge. It is many, many times bigger. And that perhaps tells you where the real focus of his time was. And of course, it wasn't just Morgan. It was many, many others. There was this complete integration, which began before the First World War, between British and American finance, finance capital. If you know, perhaps this is something that is discussed much more in Britain, I believe, than it is in the United States itself. And of course, there was also a lot of cultural interaction that came connected to it as well. This is the time when all kinds of American intellectuals who were sort of connected to this world were coming here to London. There's the house of one of them, very important house, by the way, where a lot of these people used to meet near Oxford. It's currently up for sale, just to say. So this is, I believe, where it begins. And it does evolve into a conception of some kind of technocratic government outside the political system, very different from republicanism. That such as exists in the United States, but something, as you absolutely correctly say, which is not that far removed from the political culture that had evolved in Britain in the late 19th century, where we were starting to get professional civil service and that kind of thing starts to develop. And that brings me to my next point. Anybody who ever tells you the technocratic government is objective, apolitical government simply doesn't know what they're talking about. I have lived under so-called technocratic governments. I should know technocratic government is profoundly political and inherently anti-democratic and inherently authoritarian and oligarchic. The government of the Soviet Union was in some respects, in fact, in most respects, a technocratic government. It was actually proud of the fact. They were quite open about it. The governments that we see starting to mushroom in all sorts of places in Europe, in the West, which call themselves technocratic, are that too. And you can see also, starting from around the 1920s, 30s, 40s, you start to see a proliferation of ideas about technocracy beginning to develop. You see the development in France, for example, of the Grande École, which were intended to train technocrats to run things. And it's essentially the civil service that for a long time basically operated and governed France. If you've lived in France, as I have done, you know all about this too. Remember, France was also a country with a republican tradition. And you're absolutely right to identify some of the people involved. Montagu Norman, governor of the Bank of England, still a very, very, I would say, infamous person, even in British history. A very close friend of Hjalmar Schacht, whom you were referring to, the president of the Reichsbank. Yeah. And the president, Schacht, was somebody who, through Norman, had great deal of connections to the United States, to finance capital in the United States. And it was he who set up the whole system in the early 1930s that financed German rearmament. I mean, he is a most interesting man, extremely clever man as well. And out of that world, again, you get the same people who eventually come together and create the Bretton Woods institutions that develop in 1944. Exactly. Again, I think in Britain, this is all much, much more carefully and thoroughly studied than it is in the United States itself. But it is, again, very interesting how because again, to say this once more, none of this is contrary to European political cultural traditions. I mean, we've never had a republican tradition in Britain.
Right.
But it's never existed. In France, it has, to a certain extent. In Germany, obviously, before the Second World War, absolutely not. The United States had a republican tradition, which was created in repudiation of what existed in Europe. What happened between about 1890 and 1944-45 is the whole European style of things somehow got transferred to the United States. It's a fact.
Yeah. During the Federal Reserve. But at the same time, we have to remember that the Rhodes Scholars and certainly the Frankfurt School. I mean, a lot of this stuff was out there. But then we had the twin sisters of the Council of Foreign Relations and Chatham House. Mm-hmm. And of course, the head of Council of Foreign Relations for many years was John Foster Dulles. And I believe McCloy was another guy that was involved, and Alan Dulles also. So to me, the Scharf, however you say his name, and Norman were very close with the Dulles brothers. Mm-hmm. And what it seems also is that Kissinger as well, as you said, Morgan too, said that he spent most of his time and most of his energy in the UK as well. Mm-hmm. So we have to remember that the architects, I believe, in America of how we got here include not just Kissinger and Brzezinski and the Rockefellers, but also the kind of other thing that came out of that period of time was these global NGOs, particularly in America. They have been investigated over and over since the 30s or even before then. The Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation have been accused many times in our history of circumventing and subverting the will of the people of our country. And these are global institutions. And as everyone knows, the Rockefellers paid for the land on which the United Nations is. And right down the street is the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller University. And then when you look at their money, particularly even if you go today on Rockefeller Philanthropy Partners, you're going to find everything globalist. You're going to find. And again, I believe this is what I believe at this point in my work is that I think that at the end of World War II, not only were they already planning for a third world war or what I call a financial world order that they were creating while our ancestors are dying on battlefields all over the world, but they also, I believe, created an infrastructure for protecting themselves, a global intelligence operation as well that isn't separated by by water or by you know, sovereign nations or borders. I really do believe that they pulled it off and they wanted to for the League of Nations. I mean, the book that's the most disturbing to read about this as an American is Tragedy and Hope, because Quigley just lays it out that they were never going to allow the people of the country to run the country themselves. Of course, as Rockefeller said in his own memoir, surely it's preferable for a banking class and intellectuals to run the world. Sounds very similar to what, you know, Larry Fink says at the perch at the top of the World Economic Forum right now, which is why I get in a lot of trouble when I say I'm not really sure that the Nazis lost World War II. Germany did, but I don't think the Nazis did. And then it's like, well, what are the Nazis? I mean, they've been defined differently, but you know, I'm at a place where I really believe that we have been greatly deceived. And then the murder of JFK, it ended up being, you know, a decades long cover up to protect these same people.
What would you say to those people, and I to some extent am one, who would say that the Kennedy assassination is in fact the decisive moment when the fact that it was never cleared up, that it was never sorted out, that the way in which the government basically changed and foreign policy changed, and no president since Kennedy has been like presidents were before Kennedy, and as Kennedy himself was, that the assassination of Kennedy was perhaps the decisive moment in which you could say that the deep state basically consolidated its position, entrenched its power in the United States. Because certainly, I mean, we didn't necessarily use that expression in the 60s. I don't remember, of course, I was a child then, but I don't remember people using the expression deep state then. But everybody did feel, and this went on for many years after Kennedy was assassinated, that this was a major event and a massive turning point, not just in the United States, but globally as well.
Yeah, I think that when you look at all the facts of the Kennedy situation and what he was doing at the time, particularly in Africa, or with he wanted a nuclear weapons treaty, he wanted to stop that. He was a big threat to the military industrial complex. And at the same time, that was also, I think Operation Paperclip is much bigger than people think. What we're learning, I don't know if you guys know, right now Chuck Grassley is working with Malay of Argentina to try to uncover more of the stuff from Switzerland, particularly post-World War II. I mean, 60 million people had their entire lives destroyed, all of their belongings gone, everything perished, all this gold and everything disappears. It somehow resurfaces. And, you know, to me, what we are looking at, and what I think even he's looking at, is how big was the infiltration, and not just here, around the world. Because as many people know, Dulles put a very powerful Nazi in charge of West Germany intelligence. Gallen, I think, is his name. Yes. And then, but we had a lot of that here as well. And I think JFK and his brother were starting to really, I think it was basically brothers versus brothers, the Dulles brothers versus JFK and RFK. And looking at the future of America very differently. One, I think, went the path that they wanted, which then led to the Project for a New American Century and the War on Terror and all that, where the other two were looking at, well, how can we make peace? How can we make Africa thrive? How can we be fair to South America? And then there's a lot of pieces of that go back to that both Dulles brothers were Wall Street lawyers, because they had the United Fruit Company in South America, and they had all this stuff happening. And I think JFK was trying to figure a lot of that out. He didn't want to keep Dulles in the beginning. And frankly, what happened was, I think, part psychological operation on the planet, certainly on America, because people that I talked to that were I have a good friend who is one of the only survivors of MK Ultra still alive. But a lot of people believe that the way that they went about murdering JFK was just as much to traumatize the nation into basically being suggestible to whatever was offered by the government after the murder of JFK, that our country was in mourning and a similar situation after 9/11. And that the orchestration of the murder of JFK was more a demoralizing, dehumanizing, weakening of the United States of America, the people of this country, to allow them to continue down the path that they were on, which was going into Vietnam and refueling the international military-industrial complex war machine. And when I look at that too, what happened in America, sadly enough, and I think we're going to see play out over the next several months, because I do think we're going to see some justice in America for some of these crimes. It appears at that point, the Warren Commission, which of course included Dulles and a lot of other people that shouldn't have been on it, they said this is what happened and shut the book, and they created the whole conspiracy theorist thing if you questioned it. And frankly, it appears to me that every single intelligence operative after that, be it the FBI, CIA, NSA, whatever, was a cover-up operation, one after another, under the same CIA doctrine, which the other side of it is the National Security Act, which also includes the idea of hiding things from the public for reasons of national security. Well, what I'm learning is that if the government says they are hiding something because reasons of national security, it's a good chance the government is the criminal in the situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that they started in many years after that protecting themselves over the people of this country or any country, and the intelligence agencies that were spawned from Dulles's CIA were basically rogue, and the State Department of the United States and the CIA became kind of a free agent running a separate foreign policy that had nothing to do with who. That's why I think every president that's come in until Trump maybe couldn't change anything on the global stage, because it wasn't in the president's hands. It was above the president. And I think we're at the place now where we can see it. But JFK's murder certainly started off a deception on the American people that has never stopped, because everyone that's gone in there had access to a lot of information that never came out by design.
What about the military-industrial complex? Because this is something people always talk about. President Eisenhower warned people against it in his farewell address to the American people. Again, it is obviously a very, very powerful force in the United States. It has a close symbiotic relationship with the United States government. Without the United States government, it could not exist. The United States government is its customer. It has captured its own customer in a strange kind of way. It's very strange, because it's the American government, it's the Defense Department that puts in the orders, and yet it's the military-industrial complex that sometimes tells the Defense Department through Congress and the administration what it should buy. What exact role does it have, and how does it fit into all of this?
Well, what I think, at least if you go back to the end of World War II and you look at the shift of turning on Russia and China as the bad guys, they needed a new... in the writings and readings I've been doing about Alan Dulles in particular, they realized that the war for profit model had to be, they needed public support to continue down that path. And what it appears to me is that they create through propaganda, through Nazi level propaganda, because a lot of the propagandists actually came from them into America. But what it seems is that it's an endless creation of reasons to go to war for profit. Mm-hmm. So when I look at it, I see that at the end of World War One, they shifted to the war, the Cold War, or the war on communism. Again, we then had a war on terror. Both of these things, I think, are lawfare created, because they have no enemy defined. You could change the enemy at any time. Here it's Russia, next it's Vietnam, next it's Korea. We're getting the communists, you know, when it's like, no, the communists are in our country doing that. And then the other part that is really sad, and I think is what Eisenhower warned about, which bothers me the most, is that all of our military industrial contractors who get all this money, like people get upset that we're sending money to Ukraine or we're sending money to Israel, all that money is going back to the military industrial complex, it appears, and the lobbyists who continue down the path, mm-hmm. and the propagandists who convince the public to support wars that are have nothing to do with, you know, freedom or democracy or any of this BS. But that our military industrial complex companies are traded on Wall Street is a real problem. And if you look at it, it's still this way to this day. And, you know, we're given $800 billion in defense budget every year. A lot of that defense budget cannot be accounted for. They keep failing every year for 10 years, a audit. And that is because, like I said, I think that there has been two different foreign policies, one for the international banks, Wall Street, City of London, Brussels, and run out of maybe USAID, State Department, and partners around the world, and one that we see. So for me, what I see it as is that just like the expanding of NATO or NATO still, they have to constantly create in the public opinion a reason to get the public behind going to war. So, you know, you look at the project, if your audience doesn't know about the project for a new American century, that was Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, all the people that ended up profiting off of the war on terror happened to write this full spectrum dominance military plan for the United States that the people of this country, I don't think would ever have backed if it was explained. And instead, if you look at it, the project for a new American century, which are still the neocons, I believe, pushing towards World War III, a lot of them, or they were groomed by them at the Kennedy School or at the Young Global Leaders or whatever, is still the same model. It is still a model of war for profit and consolidation under the guise of reconstruction. And I firmly believe that World War III was planned long ago. What's going on in Ukraine and Russia and the EU was not new. If you read Zig Brzezinski's book, the Grand Chessboard, or any of those things, you're going to see that it appears, particularly when Donald Trump went into office and the Five Eyes Nations pulled the coup to not allow him be president, they continued down the path across the street, basically, WESSEC advisors run by Anthony Blinken, militarizing and weaponizing Ukraine. You know, you had 12 CIA, you know, offices there. You had the bioweapons labs that Victoria Nuland admitted. Frankly, in 2015, Victoria Nuland gave a speech to the United States about the billions and billions of dollars we were pouring in to run Ukraine after Obama overthrew. Of course, I believe that you know, this is a Five Eyes operation in some respects, but overthrew the duly elected government in Ukraine with the help of public opinion being, you know, paid for through USAID and National Endowment for Democracy on the ground. Next thing you know, George Soros is popping up there with his NATO world order. In comes Clinton. And next thing you know, we're on the way to World War III surrounding Russia with NATO. And again, I believe NATO should be ended. But worse than that, I believe that they continue to create reasons to continue having wars that don't affect the people that are deciding to go to war. They only affect our children and our countries. And that's where I think we are right now, is that the people of all of our nations have to decide what kind of future they want. Do they want to continue down this technocratic, totalitarian, post, I believe, World War III Agenda 2030? Or do they want to stand up in their own nations and take back their sovereignty?
Mel, I have one very, very last question. It basically goes back to the origins. I mean, if you go, you took a time machine and went back to the United States of the 1920s, I mean, you'd have found a very different place. I mean, I'm not talking about technologies and things of that kind. I mean, it was a profoundly civilian society, for one thing. It barely had intelligence agencies in those days. It's foreign service. I once remember I looked at, you know, what the numbers were of the State Department, the number of people employed by the State Department in the 1920s. It was tiny. Henry Stimson, who was in charge of the Department of War, closed down the cryptography service, you know, the people who were listening in or trying to decipher other people's documents. He said, gentlemen, don't read other people's mail. I mean, that was the culture of the United States at that time. Now, all of this has changed. We have the structure that we have today. Can it be defeated, given how long it's been in control and how powerful and big it's become? I mean, is it possible to roll it back?
I think the most important thing is, honestly, the level of psychological warfare that the entire world has been subjected to, particularly, I believe, out of NATO. That is our biggest hurdle, is that people, I believe, in general, have been betrayed. Like I said, I believe that our debt is basically that the American taxpayer, the people that actually work in this country, that have had their country looted, all of our industries sent away, basically turned into just a consumer society and a weapons manufacturing hub at this point. I believe that our debt is because the United States taxpayer basically has paid for the entire Cold War, the entire War on Terror, the entire globalist operation that kicked off it with the Club of Rome, of course, another Rockefeller group, and then went on steroids under Bill Clinton with global warming and then global this and global that. And the whole concept that we, you know, all these global issues have to be solved by a global governance model that cannot allow nation states to make their own choices, because why would you do that? So for me at this point, it's a lot about the miseducation of our children and for the last 30 years, and even more the capture of technology kind of is making it look like, unfortunately, that the infrastructure is already built for a global public infrastructure, which is the thing that we should all be pushing back on, be it the global digital ID, digital wallet. This all came from the 70s. None of this is new. Frankly, there's an interview, I believe it was Anthony Russo was a documentary filmmaker and made a documentary or an interview with the Rockefellers at the time, saying that the end goal was to have everyone on basically track and trace surveillance on the global stage. More important to control all natural resources than actual human beings, but to find a way to what they call, what they out loud say now, to own nothing and be happy. I do believe that it's able to be defeated, because in my work, I believe we're talking about maybe 6,000-7,000 people that are actually privy to what is going on a global scale, that it is all connected. And then, you know, but your country and my country have been, it has been one psychological operation after another psychological operation. And never forget, the head during the most crucial years of the psychological warfare department in the United States was a man named Colonel Aquino, who was a avowed Satanist, ran MK Ultra under Dulles. And then we had Gottlieb and all these other things. And then, you know, you have the whole international pandemic that came up. Well, that reminds me quite a bit of the relationship between IG Farben and Standard Oil in the 30s. So, I mean, to me, I think we're still dealing with a lot of the same tentacles that, if exposed, and they're exposing themselves, they really messed up with the pandemic, in my opinion. They overplayed their hand, and I don't think they raised their children to be as strategic and didactic and backroom as they as they themselves were groomed by, you know, Rhodes or whoever else along the way, the Fabian Society, the Pilgrims, whatever you want to say. I do believe that they made a lot of strategic errors in the last 5 years in all of our countries. And like I said, I don't think any of these wars, not Israel, not Ukraine, I don't think that they're isolated. I don't think they're about what they got public opinion for. I think that this is still a international financial order that is desperately trying to keep control and find a way to extend to another 100 years of debt slavery and IMF nonsense and World Bank and all that. I believe that that is what Trump is trying to dismantle, honestly, at this point. And you know, it's not going to be easy, but I do believe it can be done.
I actually agree. I've never known the people who are in control to be as insecure and as frightened as they are now. I mean, in London, at least, you can see the signs of that everywhere around you. Mel, it's been, a massive pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
If you can just stay a little while, because I know Alex has some questions. But thank you again for answering
all my questions
so fully and thoroughly.
Thank you. I happen to be writing a book, so it's all coming out of my head.
Yeah. You have time for 10, 15 minutes of questions?
Of course, a couple questions from
viewers. Okay.
I like the people.
Awesome. from Zariel. Hi, Mel K. What's new on the Charlie Kirk front?
Well, the truth is that it is causing, again, there are so many different psychological operations right now in the United States. It's hard to tell what's really going on by design. You know, it takes me back to the Hannah Arendt talking about the totalitarianism, you know, two-step, which is, you know, get the people to believe everything and nothing at the same time. And then you can basically, you know, force them into something that they don't want, like eyes wide open into the totalitarian technocratic goals. But as for Charlie Kirk, it really woke up the country, but at the same time, it has divided the right in this country pretty dramatically from what I can see. I see from a distance. I knew him. I think he was great. But what we have going on is a very dangerous situation, because the division of those that supported Donald Trump when it comes to this topic is causing a lot of issues, both the what is going on in Israel, the murder of Charlie Kirk, and pretty much what the exposure of, you know, this last 15, 20 years of Russiagate, you can call it. It's really Spygate. It's really the growth of the intelligence, unconstitutional, in my opinion, Patriot Act intelligence that has captured all of us. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on. I just pray for, you know, Charlie Kirk and his family. Turning Point was a great thing for young people. But what it has done, again, has been used to divide the supporters of Donald Trump into different camps, it seems.
Mel K, where does Venezuela fit into this?
Well, you got to go back, I think, to the CIA first and foremost, and operations in South America, Colombia, Venezuela. A lot of the stuff I was talking about with the United Fruit and the Dulles brothers, the Rockefellers and their South America, you know, situations, which also had to do with JFK as well. And frankly, I think that Venezuela was captured long ago. I do not think that it is in any, look at what's happened to it. It used to be the most wealthy country in the world. But I do believe a lot of this I really believe that much of what is going on a global scale is the dismantling of the international intelligence network that protects the international banking network. And again, the CIA was very active in those waters. I think it has a lot to do with that maritime path that passes by there, a lot with the drugs and trafficking of humans and weapons and all of that. And also there's a lot of suggestion that Venezuela has a lot to do with manipulation of elections around the world, as Chavez, as most people know, created a program that has been used over and over. A lot of people trace Smartmatic and others to Chavez and Venezuela. So I think multiple things are playing out, but what I can see happening is the very difficult, but I think worthy task of pulling the tentacles of the international global public private partnership and banking cartel out of all of these countries. And I'm hoping that, like you said earlier, George Washington, I think, said it best, but the United States was supposed to remain basically what they said Switzerland was, which is neutral. Switzerland was never neutral. It still isn't neutral. It's never been. It is the hub of globalism. But the United States of America was supposed to remain neutral. And we are so far away from that right now. And frankly, the only way we get back to that is to be honest and dismantle what has undermined this nation's sovereignty in the form of infiltration all over the world of these international organizations, a lot of them fronts for the CIA, and to acknowledge the history that we have been lied to about in our nation, and stand up for that. That's what I think is going on in Venezuela. I think it's the unraveling of many decades of manipulation, criminality, and abuse.
From Red Panda Pie, did you see the Marjorie Taylor Greene? Did you see Marjorie Taylor Greene on Tucker? They listed MAGA's five pillars for Trump's campaign, but excused failures of Congress, like Medvedev posted. Are they deluded? Is the president of the United States even relevant regarding the deep state? Is the president of the United States relevant regarding the deep state?
I don't think he's working alone as in terms of as the United States. At this point, I can't help but believe that there is an international coalition that also, whether they are on paper, our enemies or our allies, that knows that the international banking cartel and the international organization system that was set up in the aftermath of World War II is the root of most problems on planet Earth. And frankly, I think Donald Trump is relevant on the world stage for many reasons, mostly because he knows all of this. You know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, they can make fun of him or whatever else. But Donald Trump, his father, his uncle, first of all, was at MIT with Tesla. Second, he is a very well-read person in history. Also, Mar-a-Lago has hosted world leaders for the last 35 years, including the most powerful people in the world. So I firmly believe that they're trying to dismantle the international banking cartel, IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, because none of them work for our countries. They work for an entity that is above our nations. And I believe that it's very clear to many people, particularly with what they're doing right now in the EU with Russia and wanting to steal their sovereign funds and things like this. This is a desperate ploy. And for me, I believe that a lot of the people that have invested trillions upon trillions of dollars since the 2015 signing of Agenda 2030 by Barack Obama will do anything to make sure that the globalist experiment works. And where I believe that nation states that have leaders that prefer to protect their borders, language, culture, history, and their people will be fighting back. And I think more and more countries will join that as the EU shows more and more of its true colors towards, unfortunately, what's looking a lot like a Fourth Reich. I think more and more people will start to say, we don't want that model of what the Third Reich was, a unified Europe without Russia that is running the world out of Brussels. And I mean, they can't do it anymore. And so instead, they're going to sink the entire West into chaos to make us on our knees, beg the UN or the international banks to bail us out. We're going to have to bail ourselves out. But I do believe, again, nobody in the United States has any power compared to what the American people have if they would just use it. And that is on a local scale. And it's probably like that in all the Western countries. If the local people decided that it was up to them, literally, to save their country locally, one town, one county at a time, we would see a lot of change. But as long as the people of our countries believe that the government is somehow going to change things, then we're all just playing along in a endless game of manipulation. And I do think that's happening in America, and I see it happening elsewhere all over the world, certainly. But we have to remember that, you know, there's decades here to unravel, and that's where I believe we are. But as far as Donald Trump, I think he's a beacon, at least for those who still believe in America and the founding documents and what this was supposed to be, not what it became after 1912-13.
From Natalia, do you think that the rise of BRICS challenges the deep state? Can the deep state be defeated by BRICS? How can we, people of the US and the EU, help BRICS to develop and defeat the deep state so we can also be free?
I happen to believe that, and I always have. I also happen to believe that Trump would like to participate. What I actually believe is that they're redoing the financial world order and that it will likely be backed by hard assets rather than nonsense since 1971 that's been a debt slavery model for the world. I don't know what if it's BRICS or if it's some kind of collaboration between, you know, the post-BRICS, you know, America or whatever. But I do not believe that we are going to have a world that is not working together in cooperation to make a better planet going forward. And I do believe that the United States, again, it takes me back to the Project for a New American Century and those that created or implemented the Unconstitutional Patriot Act and everything that happened since. I really believe that it's the same thing. It really goes back to what is the direction that we want to go, a militarized planet or a planet where sovereign nations protect their people of their planet and make their countries each the best that they can be, because we certainly have enough money to do everything. There is enough money in probably in that Bank of International Settlements and all of the tentacles that is protected by them to have the entire, you know, continent of Africa have clean water, electricity, internet, all of that. The whole concept of developing nations that never develop, you know, you go, you look at something like Confessions of an Economic Hitman or anything like that, and you think, God, how terrible that we've allowed this to happen. So I think that there's a different financial world economy that is going to arise out of this, but they have to get rid of the tentacles and the people that protect that first.
All right, a couple more questions from Mark Hewitt. If any, what effect did FDR's death have?
Well, you know, a lot of people still question FDR's death, and I think it had a big effect on America and the world. I do not believe that we would have gone the path of endless war for profit had he not died when he did. But in my opinion, I mean, again, we have a situation where it has been set up to have constant class struggle, constant, you know, struggle between races, between gender. It just seems to me like after FDR and then in the years after that, that again and again, from inside, we have been divided and divided and divided, where I think at the time of FDR, America wasn't in pieces. We weren't, you know, sliced in all different directions. People looked at positive solutions for everyone and how can we make that happen. And again, certainly after the murder of JFK, that never returned.
All right, one more question from Chunky Monkey. Is it naive at this point to still believe in Trump? He is a neocon and is helping the globalists undermine crypto.
Oh, I don't think he's undermining crypto. Many people in this country would say the opposite, I think. But here's the thing about Donald Trump that we have to all kind of understand finally after all these years of manipulation and propaganda on both sides. The man is just a man, okay? And the bottom line is Donald Trump running again gave the world and America particularly a chance to take back our countries ourselves. Donald Trump walked into something that is already built, in my opinion. I know people are upset about I've talked about it many times, the global public infrastructure. I certainly am disgusted that Larry Fink got promoted to the top of the World Economic Forum the same day that Trump finally, after all these years, gets to have a little detente with Russia, with Putin. That happened the exact same day. I think that there is a financial war going on above our nations that doesn't include the people of our countries. And as far as Trump, I think a lot of what he has there was already built. I also think that what they've done to him, particularly the lawfare of the last 5 years, has made him more, and the two assassination attempts, and there were many others, has made him more about, I think, wanting the American people to take back their country. I mean, he can only do so much. And he's like, you know, but the truth is, like I said, I believe that there's people all over the world in Russia and China and India and in Africa and that are on the same page of releasing this planet from this octopus of global control that was built post-World War II. And then we can start to decide after that. But as for Trump, I think Trump is giving us a chance to take back our countries, because had Kamala Harris and whoever got in there, America would have been done. There is no chance America would survive, because a lot of people don't know this, but when they had their big 75th anniversary at the United Nations, and BlackRock was there, and they relaunched the Clinton Global Initiative, and they had the IMF, and everyone was in New York City, and they're doing all that. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris signed on to not only achieving Agenda 2030 by 2030, but leading the world in achieving it. And a lot of those executive orders that were signed by AutoPen were the building of the international global public-private partnership, global public infrastructure for full track and trace surveillance of all of us, beyond borders, interoperable to technocracy. And they were all in on it. In fact, Klaus Schwab thanked then Vice President Joe Biden for being the leader in consolidating global governance. So we were in real danger. Trump coming back again was, I just think it was a respite for humanity to stop paying attention to Trump and start paying attention to what's in your backyard. Because I believe all over your country and my country, we have been infiltrated in every single way for the collapse of the West. And it can be dismantled, but not if we keep saying, I'm going to let somebody else run for city council. I'm going to let somebody else run for school board. Well, as it becomes more AI and more surveillance and more data, you better want a seat on your city council. You better want to know about, what contracts your school district are going into. And that's where I think I just see the dismantling of the tentacles of the United Nations and the international banks as key for the entire planet to free itself.
Mel Kay, thank you so much for answering questions from the viewers, thank from you. Everyone that's watching us. And thank you again for joining us on the Duran. Once again, Mel Kay, where can people find your work?
Okay, well, great. I have my website, themelkayshow.com. I have a lot of documents I think people will find interesting, including the NATO cognitive warfare document, which I think we are all being psyoped endlessly. And it's all written in there, basically, on the themelkayshow.com resource page. I have a great newsletter. I have a book out called Americans Anonymous, Restoring Power to the People, One Citizen at a Time, a recovery program for the American patriots. And I also am available wherever podcasts are, except for I am not on Telegram and I am not on YouTube. Everywhere else, I am The Mel Kay Show, and at X, I'm at Mel Kay Show.
I have those links in the description box down below, and I will also add them as a pinned comment as well. Mel Kay, thank you once again for joining us.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Take care. All right, Alexander.
No, it just brings back. Yes, absolutely. I was thinking all about all the various things. I mean, it really is going through American history. FDR, which we hardly ever talk about, actually. I should say I'm a great admirer of FDR. I think he was an exceptional president. And I also think he left a very, very difficult legacy for the United States, which the United States has never really managed to get a grip on. And he created many of the structures and institutions that have morphed into the monster that we look at today. So an interesting and complex man, and perhaps someone we should talk about one day.
Yeah, not many people talk about FDR nowadays. No. It's all about Churchill.
I know.
Everyone's a Churchill.
Strange.
Nope.
Yeah.
No one's strange. FDR.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's let's get to some more questions, Alexander. From Susan, welcome to the Duran community. Mm-hmm. SW is a new member to the Duran community. Brigitte is also a new member to the Duran community, and so is Martin Keane. Welcome, everybody, to the Duran community. Matthew says, the French deploying into Ukraine seems fairly inevitable now. They know that Trump can't do anything against the neocons. Big war inbound? Question mark.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we know about this, or at least we've been told about this by the Russian intelligence service. They're telling us that this is actually being prepared, and that Macron has put together 2,000 men, mostly according to this is entirely Russian intelligence, let me stress, and mostly people who have joined the Foreign Legion from Latin America, Well, we'll see. I think that the reality is that the NATO powers have had people on the ground in Ukraine for a very long time, many more than just 2000. The big question is this: will these people go into battle as the French Foreign Legion? In other words, will they go into battle as part of the army, the military of France, openly, you know, under the tricolour and all of that? Because that is a war. If they go there, they pretend that they're volunteers, or they pretend that they're contractors or something like that. If we have all of those subterfuges and things, then realistically, one, they're not going to make any difference. And secondly, it will be on such an insignificant scale, given the, you know, the scale of things, that I think the Russians will just make hay about it, but they won't feel that they need to do much more except amplify, because it won't go down well in France.
Yeah, 2,000 as mercenaries or contractors is nothing, but 2,000 as military, as French military, is a tripwire.
Absolutely, exactly.
Yeah. Mr. Casey says, good evening, gentlemen. Do you guys think Ukraine might end up like East Germany in terms of their political and military structure? The GDR had a police force, then later an army under the USSR's control.
Well, who knows? I don't think so, actually. I'm going to say this. If there is, when there is a collapse in Ukraine, assuming that a new political structure is created in Kiev, this is what I believe. I believe the horror, not just of the last 4 years, but of the last 30 years, going all the way, 30, 20, whatever it is, all those years going all the way back, Ukrainian independence will be so profound inside Ukraine itself that you won't need much of a dictatorship or a military structures or security structures or controls from Moscow, because people themselves there won't want to go back there again. So it might actually be a much more normal country than the one we've seen up to now, and one which gets on much better with Russia than pre-war Ukraine has done. I don't think this is impossible.
Carol Seven says, brilliant. Thanks, Mel Kay and the Duran. This turned out to be very optimistic and uplifting to listen to.
Thank you. I agree.
JJHW says, the Foreign Legion will be sheep dipped and be contractors.
I agree. I completely agree.
Thank you for that. J01, thank you for the super sticker. Brandt Lebowski says, how come she has never brought up the Gaza genocide?
I don't know that she hasn't. I mean, she did briefly touch on it during the program.
Yeah.
But she clearly doesn't approve of it or approve of the policies of the United States with respect to it. So, I'm not.
No, I think she brought it up, yeah.
I think she brought it up, exactly.
Sanjeva, Saheva, 100, but it's Sanjeva. Yeah. One of two, off subject, but Alexander, can you give a neutral and objective view about what's more important, inflation or economic growth? Many people are angry at Nabilina, but wouldn't inflation eat into fixed incomes? Part two. But then Russia has never had inflation below 4% either. But on the other hand, Turkey has 3.5% economic growth at the expense of 33% inflation.
Yes.
People say it's impossible to live in Turkey with Turkish inflation.
Well, I haven't been to Turkey for a long time. I mean, I understand the situation there is actually extremely complicated. And I've also been told that one shouldn't believe too much some of the growth numbers there. Now, I don't know, and I'm not going to talk about Turkey too much. In Russia, actually, they have had periods of inflation at around 2%. She's actually pushed inflation down to 2% on occasion. And that was contrary to her wishes. What Nabiulina is saying is, look, Russia does need to grow. The economy does need growth. It can't have, therefore, inflation at the 2% level that used to be the state, you know, the target level in the West because Russia needs to go faster than that. At the same time, if it has inflation that is higher than 4%, then it will do exactly what you said. It will cut into fixed incomes. It will also start to distort and unbalance the entire structure of the economy. It will mean that there will be a disincentive to save. It will mean that there will be less long-term investment, because Russia wants long-term investment so that it can develop high technology like aerospace, like microprocessors and that kind of thing. And it is impossible to invest and plan over the long term if you have very, very high inflation. One of the reasons why Turkey cannot develop, you know, advanced technologies in that kind of way is because however high the growth rate is, you can't invest in a project of that kind over the long term, because eventually it erodes away. So Nebulina has said 4% is the golden mean. We need higher inflation than in the West, because we need to grow faster than they do in the West in order to develop our economy better. But we also need inflation at 4% in order to maintain stability in price growth, make it attractive for people to save and possible for people to plan long term. And she's fought single-mindedly ever since she became chair of the Russian Central Bank to achieve that. And she has, to a great extent, by the way. I mean, one can look up and, you know, there's been fluctuations. But the fact that she and the central bank have had a strong anti-inflation policy has definitely meant that inflation in Russia has fallen significantly during her time. Before she became central bank chair, throughout the entire period since the fall of the Soviet Union, since, in fact, a period before the fall of the Soviet Union, inflation in Russia was always in double figures. So you can see what she's trying to do. She says 3% growth, in which you have technological development and long-term investment with stable prices, is better than 5% growth with 20% inflation, which is growth without development.
Eric Hatch says Pakrov's cauldron needs more meat. God, I hate myself.
What do you mean? I know. Thank you for you. Thank you.
Sakewa 100 Sanjeva. I'm just going to say Sanjeva because that's the handle that we know. Sanjeva at Zariel at Alex. Yes, Sakewa 100 is equal to Sanjeva. I have no idea why YouTube changed my handle. I certainly didn't do it. Deep State strikes again. Partially kidding.
Oh, okay.
Partially not. All right. Ruit says U.S. appropriates cash of the vassals and needs for Iran and Venezuela.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is a late imperial development, coming back to the discussion that we've had. The empire starts to become increasingly predatory on its own vassals, and it becomes increasingly an operation to plunder. By the way, you see that in Europe as well. Alex, if I can say, did an absolutely brilliant post on X about 2 weeks ago, in which he said that, you know, as the whole Ukraine project, you know, sort of come, we've reached that point in the Ukraine project when actually seizing things like Russian financial reserves and things of that kind becomes the absolutely central priority in order to keep the money flow, in order to keep the grift going. And I think that this is a very much what you're starting to see now.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying for a while now that when the EU takes that 200 billion or 140 billion in Russian frozen assets, that will be a big indication that we are at the end of this.
Yes.
And the EU's getting close.
We are very, very close to that. By the way, Wolfgang Munchau, formerly at the Financial Times, but obviously no longer wanted there, has run a brilliant piece about this as well. And he said that this is that what it reminds him of very much is some of this rather interesting financial experiments that happened in the immediate run-up to the 2008 financial crash. Just to say,
well, you know what it is, Alexander. In a way, it's they've given all the money they possibly could.
I know.
To Ukraine, and the only cash, the only big amount of cash that is still left, is that money in Euroclear. Yes. And so they're gonna clean that out, and then this whole thing just comes to an end. That's the way I'm seeing it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Fuzzy Ball says transit planes from Russia, China, and Iran have been coming and going from Venezuela. A lot of military supplies have been delivered. This won't be as simple as many are thinking. Venezuela has 1 million plus troops.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I'm not going to make any predictions because I don't know. Also, I'll say this. I remember that back in the summer of last year, there were reports of Russian transport planes flying to Iran with air defense systems. And it turned out that, I mean, there had been those flights, but they didn't actually come with air defense systems. So it's still not quite clear what they were transporting. No doubt one day we will know. But we don't yet know exactly what all of these flights to Venezuela are transporting as well. Venezuela is very vulnerable. I mean, it is far away from Russia, China, and Iran. It is a very big country. It's very mountainous. Much of it is jungle. I think there will be a lot of opposition and intense resistance probably to an American military intervention there. But can Venezuela, so far away from its allies, resist the might of the United States? We'll see.
The Alkali says, possible that Nebulina is part of the club, even if Putin is not.
I don't think so. I followed Nebulina for a very, very long time. And if I have to say this, I think that she is what in Germany once used to be called a national liberal, in that she does adhere quite closely to some aspects of conventional liberal economics. And she's a very, very orthodox and conventional central banker. And in some ways, in my opinion, by the way, a very good one. But she's also very much of a nationalist. Let me give an example of what I mean by that. Along with this very tight monetary policy, she has followed, which I think, you know, you can argue about it, but I think there's a very strong case that her approach actually has been long-term a beneficial one. But alongside that, she has played a massive role in cleaning up the banking system, which most people don't know. When she became central bank chair, there were hundreds of so-called banks across Russia. Most of them weren't really banks at all. They were strange institutions run by assorted oligarchs, most of them deeply connected to the Western financial system. They were described to me by a Russian banker who'd worked in one as black holes into which money went from Russia and came out in Wall Street or London or Frankfurt or those sort of places. And the very first thing she did as central bank chair was that she began a massive campaign to close them all down. And she completely wiped them out. She played a massive role in this, and it was a very difficult thing to do, and one which, as you can imagine, all kinds of people, including people in the West, strongly opposed her about. But she did it. And the result is that Russia today has a very, very solid banking system in which the four big banks are state-owned. That doesn't seem to me like the kind of action of somebody who's tied up with the global financial oligarchy.
Very true. Good example. Damnation 13 says, please click like and share the channel. Absolutely. Thank you for that, Damnation. Solaris says, Trump has taken back our country. Guest is clueless, and she never mentioned the Jewish role in the expansion of globalism. Fuzzy Ball says, is the path now for Russia to take Mykolaiv and Odessa and go all the way to the port of Odessa, then go to Trump and tell him that they are ready for a ceasefire? Trump will have zero leverage.
Well, quite possibly. I come back to what I was saying about 2 weeks ago, before all the talk of the Budapest summit started. Putin met with the military in St. Petersburg, and it was quite absolutely clear to me from what he said and from what they were doing there, visiting the tombs of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, and all of the accompanying commentary that was going around it, that he was saying, look, if the war goes on, then by all means, go on to Odessa. I know that's part of, I know that's in your plans. Just do it.
Yeah. Reaper Ractual 22 says, hi guys, I'm a fan, but why do you keep inviting Barnes? Most people in the comments think he's a propagandist.
Well, I don't.
I would say the opposite. I think exactly most people in the comments like him. We get the best reactions.
I would say that too, absolutely.
But yeah, you know. Where am I here? Linda says, will Russia help Venezuela or betray them too, like they did to Iran?
Well, they won't betray Venezuela, and they didn't betray Iran.
Did they betray Iran?
No, I was going to say, I mean, they didn't betray Iran, and they won't betray Venezuela. I mean, Russia offered Iran, we've discussed this many times, a lot of help, which Iran, for its own reasons, which were rational reasons, said no when it was offered. I mean, the Russians wanted to help Iran create an integrated air defense system. Iran said no. Now, during the actual 12-day war, I mean, it was very difficult for Russia or China, impossible for Russia and China to intervene decisively in a way that could have changed the situation. And Iran never asked them to. It didn't ask Russia or China to do that because Iran was holding its own. It was launching missile strikes against Israel, and eventually it forced the Americans and the Israelis to ask for a ceasefire. So I don't think Russia betrayed Iran. Now, this is a complete myth. As for Venezuela, it's the same. What more can Russia do beyond what it is doing now? They've just, by the way, just the last couple of days, they've ratified a strategic partnership agreement with Venezuela. They've been providing Venezuela with weapons. They've provided Venezuela with a lot of technology. Venezuela is far away. Russia doesn't have a huge fleet. What more can it do beyond what it has already done?
Sophisticated Caveman says, in your opinion, have the world powers calculated that it's better for Donbass and possibly Kiev to be administered by Russia than by a rogue Ukraine?
Well, I think some world powers might have done, but it doesn't seem to me as if that's the opinion in Europe at all. And I don't see much sign that it's the opinion in the United States either. I mean, Trump, incomprehensibly to me, continues to meet Zelensky on a regular basis. I don't know why Trump gives Zelensky the time of day, but he does.
Can't figure it out either. Chunky Monkey 329 says, my experience in working for the Australian government is that the government can pass laws, then technocrats face no consequences for refusing to implement those laws.
Absolutely. I've seen that myself. Don't forget, I was a kind of technocrat myself for a time. there's a famous joke in a British satirical TV program called Yes Minister, where an official says, I'm not a trained lawyer. That's why they put me in charge of the legal department. I've actually been in exactly that situation. I used to work in a legal department, and none of the people who headed it were ever lawyers. This is extraordinary, but it's true.
Is Kaya Kallas a diplomat?
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Well, one of the big mistakes people make, by the way, about so-called technocratic government, because this is an example, this is all bureaucracy that I'm talking about. We're not talking about the politicians above. The mistake many people make is that they think that technocratic government is competent and efficient government. My experience is it's the absolute opposite. It's government in which nothing ever happens. There's a huge amount of activity. Everybody's always busy. Some people at least are very exhausted. But in actual terms of anything materially useful being done, it doesn't happen.
Fuzzy Ball says, is the goal of Brussels to bankrupt the EU, then become indebted to the World Monetary Fund and pass real control to the WEF? Nothing else makes sense.
I think the WEF and the EU are one and the same. I didn't have much significant difference. I mean, the WEF began back in the 60s as the project basically to create European political union. I mean, that's what they called themselves at that time. They only started to call themselves the WEF, I think, in the 1980s. I mean, it's a relatively later development. So they were always aiming for the European structures that we see today. And, well, there's a huge topic to discuss there. But I think, you know, they're pretty happy with the structures that they see now.
KN Kareen says, I appreciate the Durant so much. This channel is so refreshing. Don't change. Thank you for that. KN and Jolly Lollipop says, Candace Owens, Max Blumenthal, 2028. This ticket will capture both the Black and Jewish votes.
Well, one can wish.
It'll be an interesting ticket. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Why not? All right. That is everything, Alexander. Let me just do a quick check and your final thoughts as I.
It is an extraordinary program. I mean, this is not unconventional history. I mean, there is a lot of writing about this, and it's done within academic circles, especially in Britain. It's not widely known outside, but especially the interconnections between Americans and Britons of a certain class and type and power before the First World War, that is very well established. And the developments in the 1920s and 30s, the role of people like Montagu Norman, Hjalmar Schacht, that's also been talked about quite a lot. So we touched with Mel on some really important and very interesting subjects. And by the way, if you really want to read the memoir, a very mendacious and manipulative memoir, but very interesting memoir, written by one of the people that we've been talking about today. Hjalmar Schacht wrote a very interesting memoir about how central banks work. Just saying.
I'll get to that when I'm done reading Jan Stoltenberg's memoirs.
Oh.
That he's promoting right now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I read Kamala Harris's account of the election, which is quite funny, actually. It was really funny. How I did absolutely everything right and I'm completely brilliant. Mm. And for some reason, I still lost. And it's all the fault of everyone else but me. That's basically what it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. She might run in 2028. Here's a question from Monty 1054. How high is the risk of Russia using a potential American coup in Venezuela to get some payback for all the HIMARS fired in pre-2014 Russia?
Who knows? I don't think that the Russians are looking for a confrontation with the Americans in Venezuela, because from their point of view, they're not strong there. I mean, this is so far away from their territory that it's difficult for them to project power there. But if there are attacks on their country, well, they've now said they will respond. They've been going out of their way to say it in much more forceful language than they have ever done. They've undoubtedly been listening to us on the Durant, just to say, because we pointed out that they made a massive mistake last November when they didn't react strongly. And talking seriously now, I think many people, including Putin himself, understand that.
You're talking about the Oreshnik, right?
Absolutely, the Oreshnik, yeah.
That was the response.
That was the response, but it was only one. This time, they're making it clear that if something like that happens, they will react much more strongly this time.
All right. Is there questions, Ariel, that I missed? You're telling me? I'm raising it. One second, Alexander. And anything else that you want to comment on as I check for this message, this question?
No, I think also the point she's making that the deep state extends beyond people who work in government is absolutely true. I mean, that's actually one of the most disturbing developments. I mean, if you'd gone to America in, say, 1880, you either worked for the government or you didn't. Today, that boundary has been eroded away. So you have people who absolutely do work in government. Then you have people who work in all kinds of parastate institutions, NGOs, all that kind of think tanks, all that kind of thing, who work with public money. Then you have other people who have enormous contacts inside government. All of these people meet with each other. All these people have discussions and talk with each other. And it's very difficult to know where the boundaries actually are today. And that makes this whole thing much more insidious and difficult to control and hold accountable than it used to be.
All right. We got everything. Thank you, Elza, for that super sticker. And on that note, we will end the show. So thank you to everyone that watched us on Rockfin and Odyssey, Rumble, YouTube, and our locals, theduran.locals.com. Also, check us out on Substack.
Indeed.
Look for us on Substack as well.
And to remind everybody, yep. I'm doing my live stream on Locals tomorrow.
That's right.
At 1400 hours EST, 1800 hours London time, because the clocks are different.
We switched our time.
Exactly.
Yeah. So so definitely check out Alexander tomorrow on Locals. Mm-hmm. The link is in the description box. Free to sign up. You can watch Alexander's exclusive live stream on Locals every Wednesday, and check us out on Substack as well. Alexander is also writing exclusive articles,
yeah,
which are published on Locals and on Substack as well.
Yeah.
So look for that. And we will end the live stream there. And of course, Mel K's links are in the description box and will be pinned as the first comment. So that is it for this evening, Alexander. Take care. Thank you to our moderators as well. Thank you.
To everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.